Welcome back to the Paddle and Fin Podcast Network. We're brought to you by Pelican Built Tough. For all situations, go to pelican.com. Yak Gadget. For all your fine kayak fishing accessory needs, go to yakgadget.com. Eastport Marina on the beautiful shores of Dale Hollow Lake. For all your lodging, kayaking, and fishing needs, go to eastport.info. Now let's get this show started.
Welcome back, everyone. Feather and Fur, Brad Hurlibus, another episode. Today we have on John Stagerwold with Rough Grouse Society. Welcome to the show, John.
Good to be here, Brad. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited for this one. I'm excited to talk to someone that can teach me something or another thing about forestry management and forestry practices. And I'm excited for this episode because, as all the listeners here know, rough grouse, like hunting rough grouse, is my passion. Like, it's where I really end up, like where I want to be in the fall is up north chasing those birds. So forestry management and the whole entire plan is a huge part of what I want to learn more about because I benefit so much from it.
And you're not the only one that benefits from it. You know, forests provide a lot of utility to hunters, non-hunters alike. Clean water, fresh air, aesthetic value, timber product value for forest products. I mean, I see behind you, you have an oak desk, you know, right. For example. A lot of benefits are garnered from our forest, carbon sequestration, and of course, a home for wildlife and the huntable, the game and non-game species. So
it's a big plan. It's a big plan. Before we really get into that, I like to start off my show the same way. And being that you were Rough Grouse Society and we already talked, I know you're a hunter. How did you get into hunting? Did you grow up in as a family thing? Did you take it on your own when you were older?
So I definitely grew up in it. I grew up in the North Woods of Wisconsin, outside of the city of Tomahawk. Actually grew up about 20 minutes outside of Tomahawk, and Tomahawk's a small town. I think growing up, my closest neighbor was like a half mile away. So, I mean, I grew up in the North Woods. Actually, I'm a third generation tree farmer. So definitely grew up in the woods. Hunting was definitely part of something that we did growing up. But I've got a little bit of a unique sort of background with my hunting heritage. Definitely grew up small game hunting, fishing, deer hunting. But a lot of those sort of sporting traditions took a back seat as I went off to college after I graduated from high school and, you know, started to pursue, my different career paths. And really, I had to start dropping things. First small game hunting went to the wayside, and then fishing went to the wayside. I always kept up on deer hunting, though. It was always part of more of that hunter tradition, getting back together with family around Thanksgiving for the 9-day gun deer hunting season here in Wisconsin. So always kept deer hunting as part of that tradition. But I'm part of that group that got reactivated, essentially. Yeah. So after graduating from college, you know, worked at my career for a few years, started to develop my own path and my professional career, and, you know, slowly start to develop more free time in your career, and started to pick some of those hobbies and outdoor recreation activities, hunting back up, right, that I had to let go to the wayside. So I'm definitely part of that reactivation group.
All right.
And for listeners that may not be kind of familiar with that terminology, we in the conservation realm, hunting and fishing realm, we typically talk about R3, recruitment, reactivation. I forgot what the other R is. I'm not exactly the R3 coordinator, but
getting back there. I've never heard that terminology before, so this is new to me too. I knew exactly where you're going with reactivation. Like, it made perfect sense to me, but I can't help you with that third R. I have no idea.
getting reactivated into a small game hunting was definitely part of my background. But like I said, I always kept deer hunting. Actually, until the past few years, I've been getting a little bit bored with it. definitely getting more heavily into the upland small game hunting. Just as you only have so much free time out there. There's only so many days in the year, and then vacation days and time off are even more rare. So trying to take advantage of all the opportunity that there is out there in the natural world, whether it's going after a different fish species, bodies of water they've never fished before, different small game species. I'm kind of making the circle right now in deer hunting. Those fall days are too valuable to spend solely on deer hunting. So doing a lot more of the grouse and woodcock hunting nowadays.
But that gun deer camp, though, I mean, that's such a strong tradition in Wisconsin. I'm sure you'll still be up there for opening weekend.
I try to. Of course, COVID the past couple of years kind of threw, you know, everybody, you say that and people know what you're talking about. But definitely part of our family's sort of hunting heritage going up to deer camp. I was actually just there this past week doing some cleanup work, some storm sewage cleanup work, and some habitat work, improving our habitat at that site. A never-ending battle to make sure there's good habitat out there and available.
So now that you've, so after your college career, when did you decide to move? Like was forestry always part of your college plan, being a third generation tree farmer?
It actually was not. I wanted to get into political science. Okay. Until I realized that I couldn't deny those genetically ingrained traits and career path that were kind of instilled within me. So partway through my college career, I just said I just can't handle another political science class, another ethics class. I just can't handle debating topics with people. I just want to go into more of a scientific field. I've always kind of had a more of a scientific mind, and you know, I couldn't really continue to deny sort of that predisposition to go into natural resources. So took up the field of forest management, graduated from UW Stevens Point in 2011 with a forest management degree. Worked a few years professionally within the Wisconsin County Forest System. Of course, if you're a rough grouse hunter, you're pretty familiar with the Wisconsin County Forest System because it's where a lot of the active management takes place, which means a lot of good rough grouse and woodcock hunting opportunity. Before going back to school in 2013, after a few years working professionally, I decided to go back to school for a graduate degree in wildland fire ecology. And then after that, worked in private consulting and for the state of Wisconsin for a little while before working for the Rough Grouse Society.
So do you feel like the hunting tradition kind of like brought you to Rough Grouse Society because it kind of like went hand in hand, or is it just, was it like the forestry management opportunity is just so like right where you want it to be? And that's kind of reigniting the fire for the hunting. Like what came first, chicken or the egg?
I actually want to say it's a little bit of both.
Sure.
So actually, one of the first jobs I had out of my undergraduate was working for a county forest. They had received some funds from Wild Turkey Federation and Rough Grouse Society to hire a summer intern. Okay. So I actually got a job working on rough grouse and turkey projects. So partly thanks to the Rough Grouse Society. So it was kind of always stuck with me that it was the organization that really wanted to be active in management, do the type of management that I really wanted to pursue. So it kind of seemed like a natural fit.
Nice. I'm always impressed when people can find a career that's really like in their passion. Do you know what I mean? Like that when things actually like work out, like I love my job, but it's not my passion at all. Like, and maybe it's a good balance for me being completely right field in my job compared to like being in the hunting, like being in that field every day. But like for that, if you get like that passion and then just be able to find a career in it, like it just like that always amazes me that people are able to chase that and make it happen. So that's really cool. Like that's a really cool story.
Well, thanks.
So with the Rough Grouse Society, you're over the Great Lakes region, is it?
So I cover a seven state region. I cover the western and eastern Great Lakes. We're talking Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. That's sort of officially, but I do work a little bit in Washington State and North Dakota. We do have a chapter in Washington State and working on pursuing some projects in North Dakota around the Turtle Mountain region, where there are some rough grouse in North Dakota, of all places.
Interesting. Interesting. So I guess maybe we should start there. Where is Rough Grouse Society's footprint for the most part? Is that just in the Midwest mainly? I mean, because you said one project in Washington, so no.
But mostly, we're mostly in the upper Midwest and eastern United States. So all through New England, down to the southern Appalachian region, all the Great Lakes and upper Midwest. We do actually have some association to RGS Canada. So there's a Rough Grouse Society in Canada. It gets a little bit tricky because of you're talking about being an international nonprofit organization and how things are communicated and dollars are work between Canada and the U.S. But we have members all over the United States, people who are passionate about rough grouse hunting. And we've got members down in Texas. Of course, there aren't any rough grouse down in Texas, but they love coming up to the upper Midwest and rough grouse hunting. Washington State, there are rough grouse in Washington State, and it's an interesting state to do projects in because it's the only time I really get to work with some of the western tree species.
Sure. So sequoias, I'm assuming that do they have sequoias there? Or?
They do not have sequoias, at least not in the natural range.
Got it.
Don't have them naturally in Washington State. Eastern hemlock, for example, is planted out there as a rough grouse habitat species.
I wasn't sure what all the difference up because I lived in California for almost a year, and like the sequoias just blew my mind when I was out there. So I wasn't sure how far north they went.
Well, the sequoias are fascinating. They don't feel real.
they're just so big and so monstrous, and that was my first experience with like habitat. Cause I don't remember if we were at a federal or state wildlife thing, but they were talking about it and they were talking about like back in, I believe it was the '50s and '60s, like their forestry pack, like they weren't getting new sequoias. Like they just weren't, like the seeds weren't spreading and it was cause there was no wildfires.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I had really heard that certain trees need wildfire to produce like the seeds. So you get more trees. Like I never realized that until they were talking about it, and like, well, the fire clears out the brush and it gives them a fresh hole. So I'm like, interesting. Like never like that. That's like a whole lot of nature right there.
The fire ecology of giant sequoias and redwoods is absolutely fascinating. Of course, like I mentioned, some of my background is in wild and fire ecology. And, there are a lot of habitat active forest management issues that are happening in California. Of course, if you paid any attention to the wildfires that are occurring out there, it has a lot to do with the wild urban interface and how really we're building homes in places that really there shouldn't be homes. They are definitely fire dependent communities, definitely stuff related to invasive or exotic species like eucalyptus being fire prone and adding to the fire danger in those areas. And of course, climate change, drought, a lot of those type of issues, but there's also a large lack of forest management in certain areas of California. And actually, when it comes to the ecology and management of giant sequoias, the invasion of white spruce is a concern. White spruce is a species. It's a native tree, but it tends to invade sites in the absence of fire. And then when a fire eventually goes through, it helps fire carry up into the canopies of giant sequoia. And then you talk about, several hundred thousand year old trees getting scorched and dying because there's been such a deficit of fire on the landscape for so many years that you add to that fire danger and eventually turn what would be just low intensity ground fires, maintaining a healthy ecosystem, into catastrophic canopy fires that are drastically changing those ecosystems.
That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot to think about right there alone. I mean,
it's a lot to think about there, but you know, right now there's an active fire in the Pigeon River State Forest in lower Michigan, I guess the lower peninsula of Michigan.
Sure.
And it kind of, you know, that's really, that fire right now is in the footprint of, not exactly the footprint, but right in the backyard of the Mack Lake fire that happened in the 1980s. And it's just a reminder that the Lake States here, we are definitely a fire-dependent community and ecosystem. You know, we had the anniversary of the German Road fire here in Wisconsin just this past week. And of course, last year was the Green Lake fire in Minnesota, a relatively large wildfire. We are definitely a fire-dependent ecosystem here in the Upper Great Lakes.
And that's probably something I never really think about that. I mean, I know the importance of like controlled burns for invasive species and all of that stuff, but I never really think about the bigger, like I don't think about necessarily that in forestry management though. I think about that in like native wildgrass areas and marshes and cattail management, things like that. I don't necessarily think about our forests also need fire and are fire dependent too.
The research is pointing more and more that fire is really important for a lot of our ecosystems, even ecosystems we wouldn't traditionally think as being fire dependent, but having the occasional maintenance fire go through actually plays a lot into what the species richness and biodiversity are of those specific areas. You know, to give you some frame and context, some recent research actually points to the fact that the Amazon rainforest itself is a fire dependent ecosystem. But it just happens at a completely different scale of what we think about.
Sure.
Amazon rainforest is frequented by lightning. And individual trees might be lightning struck. And so those individual trees will be struck, burn out, and have a small canopy gap created over time. But because of the repetitive nature of all the lightning, you have on a landscape scale, essentially replacement fires. They're happening through single tree replacement of lightning struck trees. So there's a lot that we have to learn yet about wildland fire and how it really plays into a process on the ecosystem as far as maintaining healthy ecosystems. We in forestry, you know, foresters, we tend to think of fire as being a treatment. So if we're trying to, let's say we want to convert an area to oak or maintain an area as an oak forest, we would put a prescribed burn through it in a year that we have a good acorn crop, help to try to promote oak to stay on those type of sites. But really the cutting edge research is really hinting at that fire is not like a treatment. It's a natural process that we have to maintain over time.
Sure.
Or we run into those issues like we said, we have in the Western states.
Right, where you have all that, where it just becomes such a fuel, like it's got so much fuel there when the fire does happen. But it's just, it's not that, like what you said, was that low ground burn anymore. It's all the way to the canopy and it's causing catastrophic damage to the forest itself then.
Exactly, but even the other issue of that we're not maintaining what would normally be healthy ecosystems with greater plant and species diversity and richness.
Sure, sure. It's a lot. I mean, so how do you?
You didn't think we're gonna go here when we?
No, that's good. I'm liking it though. I really am. Like, I love knowledge. Like, I just love to learn and like those random tidbits and facts that I pick up. Like knowing that the Sequoia was fire dependent. Like I've talked to other people about that. They're like, "What are you talking about? Like, how do you even know that?" I'm like, "I don't know. It's just something I picked up a long time."
My big head's been blocking it, but. Actually, here's a tree cookie from my graduate research project that I conducted. That's a 278-year-old red pine that we took from northern Wisconsin that had regular intervals of fire on it leading up to European settlement in 1880. It's actually almost like clockwork. That tree had a fire scar every 10 to 12 years leading up to 1880. When fire was shut off, essentially when Europeans moved in, you know, large scale agriculture started to take place, logging practices removed a lot of trees. This was actually in a more or less a preserve, that was set aside by one of the notable logging camps and timber barons of the day. And it kind of tells a great story about Native American fires, anthropogenic fires, and how they used fire as more or less a maintenance treatment in that landscape at that time before European settlement to help maintain healthy hunting grounds, berry picking grounds, thinking about, you know, how people had to subsist off the landscape.
Sure.
And you think about in this particular region of the United States, how quickly an area could revegetate, grow back up to be unhuntable. I gave this example of you run a fire through and about 10 years later, it's going to be pretty full of brush. Well, how do you find game very easily using the tools at the time, that era, to hunt your quarry? It becomes pretty hard. So people probably sent a fire through it saying, it needs to be burned again to help promote some game species.
Sure. I didn't realize Native Americans used fire. I didn't realize they had any, like, I didn't know they practiced forestry, I guess, in that way. Like, that's the first I've ever heard of that.
They definitely did. Actually, the Menominee tribe here in Wisconsin has one of the longest traditions of what we might consider modern day forestry in that regard. Still actively managing their forests with forest management and fire. But, you know, this was just one part of that research study that we had done. But there are many other studies that are being done right now in the Great Lakes related to fire, even out on the East Coast, thinking like Pennsylvania, a lot of studies being done about how really fire is a more major part of the landscape and the ecology. One of my study sites actually found that fire frequented it about every 5 years before a European settlement. So there's typically a range that we saw with certain sites. Usually every other year to every 20 years was pretty normal, what the research is pointing to. But it also greatly depends upon those forest cover types too. You know, there's definitely a difference between an area that was more dominated by hardwoods being less frequented by fire, areas that were more dominated by pine being more frequented by fire. And a lot of species that we don't think probably benefited from fire might have, rough grouse included.
Right.
Actually, there's some research out from the eastern United States that points to fire after harvesting aspen actually can produce denser thickets of aspen to sprout back up after that logging and fire practice.
Interesting.
Meaning better rough grouse habitat.
Right. So using logging and after logging, coming back through with the fire, then afterwards to promote even better forest.
Exactly.
So fire is one tool that obviously you're familiar with, part of your degree as a man and everything else. What are some of the other common tools that you use as a forester? I mean, harvesting obviously is a common one, but are there any other like ones that most people wouldn't necessarily think of?
Well, what did Aldo Leopold say? He said, axe, plow, fire, cow. You know, there's a wide range of tools in our toolbox to use. You know, fire is one of them. It certainly isn't the only one. It has its applications. It has its drawbacks. You know, it's definitely very seasonally dependent, weather dependent. We can't always get what we need done through prescribed burning. So there are other tools in that toolbox that we need to and do look at in forestry. Obviously, timber harvesting is one of our biggest and best tools because we're not as restricted by seasonality with it. You know, we definitely do try to push timber harvesting towards times of year that are more conducive to harvesting specific species and ground conditions to make sure we're not impacting soil quality, water quality. And focus on when we can most effectively regenerate trees back. But forestry practices, timber harvesting is definitely one of those tools in our toolbox. Herbivory and grazing is definitely another tool that we talk about in the forestry realm. But actually more commonly than not, we talk about the impacts of deer browse on forestry. You know, thinking back before, again, European settlement, at a time when Wisconsin, we had elk and woodland bison across the landscape, and deer managing the herbivory part of our landscape. Now today it's largely just white-tailed deer, but some counties have deer densities right. that can actually impact forest regeneration. And when we talk about holistic management, we're talking about how forest regeneration can actually be so impacted that now we don't get the stem density back in a stand of aspen or oak or hardwoods that would actually then be conducive to rough grouse habitat. So it all kind of fits together as far as how we should be managing these ecosystems, just like you're kind of hinting at, as we need to be using our multiple tools we have available.
Right, right. And
including the science.
And when you're managing a forest, you're not, I mean, you're part of Rough Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society, but you're not just managing it only for grouse. I mean, you're managing for a healthy forest.
Yeah, we definitely are. We're looking to manage healthy ecosystems, healthy forested landscapes, diverse forested landscapes. When we think of the rough grouse as this bellwether for forest health, because rough grouse are kind of unique in that we think of them as a young forest species, but that's actually a misnomer. They're not a young forest species, just a young forest species. They're diverse forest species. When you and I are out there hunting, we're typically running into rough grouse in the fall, and it just so happens in the fall, rough grouse are utilizing young forest.
Sure.
But other times of the year, they're using different forested types. You know, right now, this time of year, rough grouse are nesting. They're nesting at the base of mature trees is where they're nesting. They need, literally forest period, they're drumming. They need mature trees that fell down to have a drumming log to drum off of. There are other forest types that are really important to the rough grouse ecology. You know, most hunters are going out in October. Obviously, they're going out hunting, but you start to get into late season rough grouse hunting, that's where you really kind of can parse out who really knows more about rough grouse ecology, biology, and the habitat that those grouse are using at that time of year. Because you have hunters start to move into some of the more mature aspen stands that actually have a brushy, shrubby understory, because sure. that's where the rough grouse are moving into at that time of year. So they're really, when you talk about rough grouse management and ecology, you're talking about a diverse forest species that's utilizing multiple age classes of forests. And that's why they're a bellwether for forest health, because if we have young forests, mid-age forests, and older forests, we're managing everything rough grouse needs. Of course, there's the other part in there that rough grouse have a very small home range.
Right.
When the rough grouse brood start to break up, grouse can travel 2-4 miles, individuals can, but after they kind of, they land and figure out where they're going to be spending the rest of their life, most of them won't leave an 8 to 12 acre area. So they have
a really small
home range, very, very small home range. And so what that means is that really within that 8 to 12 acre area, we need to provide all that diversity of forest habitat that those rough grouse need. So really, they're a bellwether for forest health. They're a champion for diverse forest management, and that's what we talk about at Rough Grouse Society. Is how do we make sure we have diverse forests that we're managing?
And that's a long term plan. I mean, this isn't just something you can sit down today and be like, "We're going to create diverse." Well, you can't just like. This can't just happen overnight. This because like you said, you have young forests, you have middle-aged forests, and then you have the older forest. Well, the older forest is there. You can create new forest right away. Well, not right away, but it's that middle-aged forest that matures over time.
So it's definitely something that you need to keep kind of your head on a swivel about and be mindful of as you're talking about your forest planning. Because you can, the forest is going to continue to age. Just like us, time is inevitable. It's going to continue to age. And if you don't pay attention to what you're doing when it comes to your forest management, you can have a situation where all your forest is now suddenly old and you are lacking that young forest component. But now you're really behind the eight ball, because by the time you might get started creating some of that young forest habitat, your mid-age forest habitat is now aging into your mature stuff. And so sure. You can run into a situation where you're just basically on a treadmill. You're just trying to create enough young forest habitat to provide the basic needs of many forest wildlife species. But without that thoughtful planning, looking years and decades ahead as far as how you're going to make sure you can continually keep diverse forest habitats and landscape, you're going to fall behind the eight ball.
That's so I don't want to get crazy into planning or anything like that. What on a typical plan, is it a 20 year, a 50 year, a 100 year? Is it all of that in different stages? Like, how does it, like, super high level overview? Like, what is, like, what's a plan length normally?
It largely depends upon ownership. Okay. You know, when we think about the landowner demographics, there are a lot of different forest landowners. You know, there's Forest Service land, county forest land, school trust land, state forest land, state wildlife areas, industrial forests, private land ownerships, you know, land owned by NGOs, like right. Rough Grouse Society. So there's a real, you know, you have to be understanding and knowledgeable about the landowner demographics across the spectrum. Because each one's going to have different set of goals and targets in mind, managing different timescales. But typically, you think more holistically and long term in thinking about a 100-year plan if you're a public landowner. But a 100-year plan is not going to be an all-encompassing document. It's going to be sort of, this is where we want to head over time. But it's not going to have the specifics of how you really get there. How you get there is going to be really dependent upon a 25-year plan, a 15-year plan, to basically set those targets and goals for that 15-year period. Say, here's how we're going to get here step by step over the next 15 years to then work our way towards that 100-year plan. So every 15 years, you're reevaluating your plan to look at, well, are we meeting our targets, our goals to get towards that 100-year planning effort and where we said we wanted to be? And then checking it along the way to see if you're getting there. You know, that's when it might come to landowner, you know, public land ownership. Private land ownership, believe it or not, you know, again, I keep saying Wisconsin, but you and I are in the state of Wisconsin.
Right. No, it's all right. I've had plenty of episodes that I've never left the state of Wisconsin in our conversation, so we're fine.
Well, land ownership demographics, private land ownership in the state of Wisconsin, surprisingly enough, changes hands on average every 7 years for forested land. So it's actually, you're talking about an extremely short period of time to be managing your land on. If it's being sold every 7 years, which creates a lot of problems in the forest products industry, especially when you think about how we can sustainably manage some of these lands. You might have somebody who's very conducive to managing your lands right now, and a forest manager might say, everything that we need to do, we have to do right now because we have a motivated landowner who wants to actively manage his forest, and we have to cut it now because in 2 years, this person might sell this property and you may have somebody who doesn't want to harvest that land. So then by the time you'd get through your planning process, you might have gotten ahead of the game now, but the next ownership, you might get behind the game. Sure. So it creates a lot of problems as far as how we look at managing our private land ownership as part of the habitat solution. There are some unique programs, especially here in Wisconsin. We have the Managed Forest Law Program, which has been largely successful for the state of Wisconsin. About 3.5 million acres of private land ownership are within the Managed Forest Law Program. Every single one of those properties has either a 25 or 50 year management plan with them and are basically locked into that management for 25 to 50 years to make it a much easier process to manage sustainably on those lands. But then Rough Grouse Society, we do things on top of that. We actually have three staff members in the state of Wisconsin currently. Actually, we're working on more. But we have three staff members who are dedicated to assisting private landowners with managing their lands sustainably. So we actually have a position in Whitehall, Wisconsin, one in Spooner, Wisconsin, and one in Anago.
Nice. And when you're working with private landowners, that would be property not enrolled in MLF then, correct?
At MFL, but MFL, sorry. They can be enrolled in it. So basically, we're helping to be part of the conversation on how to, for starters, manage those properties. work with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service to help incentivize landowners to manage in a specific way for forest habitat outcomes.
All right. I knew there was a plan. My father-in-law has 40 acres enrolled in MFL closed. Open versus closed. For those that don't know, one's open to public hunting, one's closed to public hunting. There's some different tax benefits. I'm not going to go into that whole story. Anyways, so, and his land's been logged once, but I didn't know that when they enroll, they set long-term plans for that property. That it's actually kind of cool to hear that actually.
Yeah. You essentially have a 25-year plan that's the bare minimum to be in the program is a 25-year plan. And essentially your forest is looked at a stand-by-stand basis. And what that means is if you have aspen on your property, they're going to write you a prescription to manage your aspen one way, as opposed to if you have red pine on your property, they're going to write you a prescription to manage that a different way. Sure. If you have both species on your property, you're going to have two different prescriptions. And those prescriptions sometimes overlap, sometimes they don't. So actually in the lifetime of that plan, you might be coming back multiple times to do timber harvest on your property to keep and maintain it as a healthy forest. Now, the state does also have other programs. They just have a stewardship program where actually you can get a 10 or 15 year plan written. Our staff do write some of those plans, the 10 or 15 year plans, which don't have any sort of tax implications or regulatory authority tied to it. It's just basically making best recommendations on how to manage property. But there, chances are, if you're a private landowner in this state, especially, there's a box that you fit in as far as programs that would be appealing to you to manage your property in a way that you want to, if you want to actively manage it.
Sure. Sure. And right now that property that I'm on, it's really at a really sweet spot from where it is. I don't know how many years ago it was harvest, but it's pretty diverse. And granted, I'm way too far south to really have grouse. I mean, I have heard the occasional drummer this far south, but there's so few and far between. There's no way I could never even chase him with a dog. I just couldn't do it. And if I ever accidentally would flush one, if I'm running into something like woodcock habitat, I'd be in awe. Like, there's just no way. There's too few and far between. I think, no, I can't ethically harvest one down here. That's just me though. Our land right now is in this, like the deer population's healthy in the area. Like, they're using different parts of our land. We get woodcock that migrate through. We have good, there's a lot of songbirds that come through there and squirrel. It's a really just healthy, diverse forest. And I wasn't sure if, and I knew it didn't happen by accident, right? At least I hoped it didn't happen by accident. And it's more than just, oh, we're just going to log it and let it grow. I grow back. I didn't think that would be the plan. So it's interesting to hear that they actually put a plan in place for these properties.
They do. It relies heavily upon a lot of forward thinking by the state, taking on the action of helping write these plans, and also an army of private forestry consultants that actually now work to actually draft these plans, help implement the practices on the ground.
That's really cool to hear. I mean, and I've seen it firsthand. I've seen the benefit of it because I've hunted other private property before. And just because you have private property doesn't, like, I've hunted private property before that was not managed at all. It was generations old and there were no deer. It was like, and we were there for deer hunting is why I was there. But it's like, no, like, this isn't, like, I was here for the experience because of the people I was with, but we were there for the experience for the people because the deer hunting was not in that part of the woods.
And you know, and you asked a little bit earlier about, you know, maybe why I chose RGS as sort of a career path, why I work for RGS. And that is one of the things I do love about the Rough Grouse Society is that we do talk about diverse forest management, largely again because rough grouse are the bellwether for healthy forests. And it's something that I think rough grouse hunters are really in tune with and understanding, that the need for diverse and healthy forest landscapes, not just for the sake of rough grouse, but for a wide range of forest wildlife, game and non-game species, that I don't think you get a lot of times with other hunters in the hunting communities. And I'll give this example that with going back to oak trees, that a lot of hunters, a lot of landowners who are deer hunters that I interact with are always very hesitant to harvest their oaks and sure. manage their oaks actively. A lot of deer hunters, they don't want to screw up the acorns.
Right.
They tend to think about keeping the oak trees so that deer have acorns to eat, not thinking that, you know, more holistically, that acorns might be available for a month out of the year. And
right.
deer need other things to eat as well. They need cover. They need escape cover. They need cover to raise their young. They need winter browse habitat. They need herbs, forbs, and grasses to browse upon. So there's a lot more that needs to happen in these forests than just managing mature oak cover type to produce acorns for a month out of the year. You really need to be talking again about how are we managing diverse forests for white-tailed deer.
And that kind of goes back to what you said about rough grouse hunting in fall. They're in younger forests a lot of times. So that's where you get that impression that they need young forest when that's not the case. They need a diverse forest. So
yeah.
I understand that correlation completely because I can't count on it. Like, oh, we need to find the acorns. Well, if there's nothing else there but an oak stand is for miles, that's probably not going to hold much for animals at that point.
Exactly. It's really trying to find that balance of healthy, diverse forests when you're hunting forested areas for whitetail deer.
Sure.
Of course, you're starting into the agroforestry or farm forest interface areas. That there's different things at play when you have corn on the landscape.
Right. When there's corn, then you've got some. If there's still some hedgerows in between farms for bedding, like everything starts to change. You add a little water in the mix.
But that might be a little bit of my bias hunting in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, where we're definitely not in farm country.
No, and I've hunted. I used to hunt up there a lot for our deer camp was up there when my best friend's father was still around before they moved back south. I think we were up there for 5 or 7 years for deer camp straight, and it's completely different hunting the big woods. And we were up in Vilas County. So it's completely different up there than where it is now, where I hunt in Columbia County. And while we have a wooded section, it's a lot of farmland around us too. I mean, it is a completely, it's a diverse landscape between, you have marsh, you have wooded property lines, wooded property lots with big farms all around it. So it's a completely different experience between the two. So I understand exactly what you're saying. Yeah. When you're hunting the big timber up north, it's completely different.
For sure.
So, boy, I don't even know where to take this yet. Do you want to talk about any, like, I don't want to get too much, like, I don't want, like, a lot of my shows go long and they go more than an hour. And everybody who listens to me knows that I never get out in a show in less than an hour. Most of them are an hour and a half. But is there any projects you want to talk about that you're currently working on that were, like, that are just, like, this, like, really was, like, for me right now, like my golden goose. Like, this thing is, like, I worked really hard to make this project happen and it's coming to fruition. And like, this one's really to be excited about.
Actually, yeah, there's a lot going on talking about forest conservation, the work that we're doing within the Rough Grouse Society. I guess for starters, I have to say our chapters are all being really active this time of year. A lot of them are getting out, handling and managing a lot of their chapter habitat projects, having habitat days, doing tree planting, shrub planting, trail maintenance work, pollinator planting, clover planting work. So there's a lot of work that the chapters are doing right now. Garbage pickup and cleanup at sure. different wildlife sites. So, shout out to our membership and the chapters are doing a lot of hard work right now, getting out there and being active, helping to give a good face in front to the society, working with a lot of local managers on their respective projects. But me regionally, some of the big projects that RGS we're working on right now, by far the biggest one and the one that I'm most excited about is how the Rough Grouse Society is engaging with shared stewardship with the Forest Service. Currently this past winter we harvested our very first shared stewardship project with the Chippewa National Forest in Minnesota, which was an 83-acre timber sale project on the Tower Lake and Morph Meadows Hunter Walking Trails on the Chippewa National Forest. And actually, RGS being a very taken a very active role in the timber management of these hunter walking trails on the national forest as part of shared stewardship, and then taking the revenue that was generated from those timber sales and reinvesting it back into the forest where it came off of, hiring contractors to do additional trail maintenance work, rehabilitation work, and habitat work on the Chippewa National Forest. It's a model that we're taking to other national forests. We're actually in the process of finalizing an agreement with the Manistee National Forest in Southern Michigan. We're working on two separate agreements right now, as well with the Ottawa National Forest. And we're also working on completing one, another one, I should say, with the Chippewa National Forest. So we're taking a very active role in forest management through this tool called Shared Stewardship. And it's a very exciting time to be part of the Ruffed Grouse Society because of those efforts.
So what exactly does shared stewardship mean? Does that mean that the Ruffed Grouse Society is controlling public land, the management of it?
It doesn't necessarily mean that. If you're to boil it down, what it essentially means is that we're given the opportunity to help the Forest Service manage some of their timber. So it's where the Forest Service has basically identified us as a partner, saying that you have these goals and objectives in mind to do X, Y, and Z. We have these forested areas that are have gone through planning, have gone through the approval process, public commenting process. We're going to manage these really in line with what you guys are prescribing and want to manage. Let's work together to have some shared stewardship of these forested areas, allow RGS to take a more active role in helping us do the timber sale establishment, bidding and harvesting of that timber, and then taking that revenue that's generated from the timber, because of course in our region, timber generates a lot of revenue to help manage forests. So taking that revenue and then reinvesting it back into that local forest to do a bunch of additional habitat projects and treatments. So on the Chippewa National Forest, for example, we mowed just shy of 100 miles of hunter walking trails, maintaining them. We installed 10 trailheads, and we're looking at basically, and we haven't even spent all the revenue yet. So we're looking at what are we going to do this year as far as additional habitat projects, looking at some pollinator planting work, looking at doing some additional trail mowing, additional gate work, and additional timber harvest establishment work through that shared stewardship. So it's kind of a win-win for the Ruffed Grouse Society. We get to take an active role in managing the forest. We get to reinvest that money back into the local communities, local forests. Forest Service loves it because we help complete their work objectives.
Sure.
So we help to take some of the workload burden off of them. And of course, they're monitoring the work that we do all the time. So it's very close communication as far as what we're working on and making sure that we're meeting all their steps, guidelines, and in accordance with those forest management plans. And they're also, I mean, just the folks I've worked with on the Chippewa National Forest, for example, they take a lot of pride in their forest. And you know, they face a lot of budget constraints, like a lot of private individuals, a lot of county, state, federal government agencies. They've got budget constraints and can't always get the things done that they want to get done in the forest. And I mean, I've seen forest managers almost come to tears, just happy about some of the work that we're able to do to install new gates, for example, on some trails. Just that they had wanted for years to have new gates, and they're working the gates that are all shot full of holes, beat up, bent up, pulled out of the ground, and they were able to come in and like I said, reinvest that money back in the local community. And you have these Forest Service employees who are they're taking a lot of pride in the work that we're getting done through the shared stewardship, because they are seeing how we're rehabilitating these assets for the public.
Right. No, that's awesome. Like that's. Is that a new program then? Is that relatively, it sounds like it must be relatively new.
It's relatively new in the grand scheme of things. It's if you've heard of Good Neighbor Authority, it's basically related to the Good Neighbor Authority, which GNA has allowed the states to take an active role. So Wisconsin DNR, Michigan DNR, Minnesota DNR are all taking active roles in a similar type program. Shared stewardship is basically how nonprofit organizations interact with the Forest Service through that shared stewardship.
Got it. And then when you start a program like that, and when Rough Grouse, are there other nonprofits involved as well then? Or do they really just do one nonprofit? Like, would you be in a project with also, let's say, the Wild Turkey Federation? Like, would you two work together on?
There are actually, we okay. have in my region, of course, again, I've got a big region,
right.
extending all the way to Ohio. And actually, we've been discussing some projects on the Wayne National Forest with the Wild Turkey Federation. So actually, the Forest Service will work with this is not just an RGS Forest Service thing. This is really the opportunity has opened up to a wide range of conservation nonprofit organizations. They're looking at how the goals and objectives align with those conservation nonprofits. But we, believe me, we're all in communication and talking behind the scenes, RGS, American Bird Conservancy, Wild Turkey Federation. We're all talking about how we can really meet these capacity issues and questions about how we can help them with a project, they can help us with a project, and we can work together for these really these shared conservation goals and objectives.
Got it. I wasn't sure if they tend to pick one organization or if they'll bring multiple organizations in. Sometimes too many roosters in the hen house can cause issues, and I wasn't sure what they did to try to make sure that doesn't happen. But I guess at the end of the day, it's the National Forest that's still in charge.
At the end of the day, it's up to those Forest Service processes. They go through planning, public commenting, their NEPA approval process. So they have a lot of oversight in as far as what we do. But again, it's a tool in a toolbox for the Forest Service to be able to do a lot of this work on the ground that they want to get done. At the end of the day, it's not always about the timber harvest. The timber harvest is a big portion of what we're doing, but it's that reinvestment of those dollars back into those areas that is very important. But there's, that's not the only way that we actually engage with the National Forests. For example, the Superior National Forest, we are working with them on a $1.8 million grant in the state of Minnesota as part of what's called the Moose Habitat Collaborative. So they're again thinking about rough grouse, diverse forests we need. That includes managing moose habitat. Moose habitat is a lot of crossover for grouse and woodcock habitat. So we're actually working with the Superior National Forest on a $1.8 million grant that RGS helped secure with some of our other partners, Nature Conservancy, Minnesota DNR, Superior National Forest, various county agencies. And we're actually helping to apply that grant to the Superior National Forest. Similarly, in Minnesota, we secured a $300,000 grant through what's called LCCMR to basically reinvest that $300,000 into hunter walking trails across northern Minnesota, which includes Chippewa National Forest. So there are other ways that we engage with the National Forest, and sometimes that means securing grant funds and working with those National Forests to spend those grant dollars on the forest.
That's a lot. I mean, those are some major grants right there, and that can provide a lot. If you also get some timber harvest money in with it, I mean, that's a lot of money that can be reinvested into those forests.
It's a big program. I get asked all the time, how do I balance 7 states officially? And what a lot of it comes down to is we are getting a lot of momentum here at the Rough Grouse Society. We're doing a lot of good work on the ground, and the work is helping to pay for itself. And we're in the process right now of hiring a lot of staff in the Great Lakes region. We just brought on board a brand new conservation coordinator for the state of Minnesota, a gentleman by the name of Scott Johnson. We're actually currently advertising a conservation coordinator for Michigan. So we're bringing on a new coordinator there. Our private lands program, the state of Wisconsin, has continued to grow. So we're actually at 3 private land staff for the state of Wisconsin. And we're going to have some other big things coming down the pipeline very shortly. We are really expanding here at RGS. So if you
want to
be part of a, if you want to be part of a forest dedicated conservation nonprofit in 2022 and beyond, RGS is where you want to be.
That it's good to hear that there's a really good push and a drive behind it. And when you can see the benefits from it with how you're working with these different national forests and helping with the plans and all that, it's easy to see like what impact rough grouse society is having on the landscape in a good way by creating these diverse forests. I've hunted rough grouse areas before, like managed like rough grouse society project areas and things like that. And you can see the work that gets put into them.
And it's not just the, you know, our RGS here. I also want to, you know, say it relies heavily upon our partners.
Sure.
Partners are key. Having dedicated people on board, dedicated members of the society, of not just RGS, but also the American Woodcock Society, and having dedicated land managers on board within the Forest Service, state, county agencies are all, it's critical to have partners on board to get this work done the way we need to get it done.
It takes a village. That's what they say, right?
Exactly.
But even like just to organize all that's a feat in itself, even just to get everybody on the same page and actually make steps forward rather than just constantly talking in circles that's hard enough in itself. And then when you look at these projects and some of the projects I've seen and the projects you're talking about and the miles and miles of mowed trails you've put in and pollinator projects as well, which I want to touch base on here quick too, because I had no idea Rough Grouse Society had anything to do with that.
Well, yeah, we can talk plenty about pollinator work.
I had no idea that was part of Rough Grouse Society's like plan. Like for the, I understand it'd be part of forest management, but I just never really put the two and two together that you want healthy forests. Healthy forest takes pollinators too.
Well, so non-forested openings are pretty important to not just to rough grouse, but actually American woodcock. So sure. Non-forested openings are critical part of woodcock mating displays. And how they seek out those open areas and then fly up and do their sky dance. When we specifically think about rough grouse, pollinator plantings are very important for invertebrates. So when we think about, you know, more holistically about rough grouse and rough grouse management, we need to get outside the mindset of managing just for young forest in the fall. When we're out there hunting, right? We need to be thinking about what are young rough grouse brood eating during the spring and early summer months when their diet is primarily insects. So, you know, 90 to 100% of their diet is going to be insects from the moment they hatch to the moment that they're young juveniles. So if we can engage in projects like pollinator plantings that can produce not just one type of insect or a couple types of insect, but a diversity of insects, thinking about related to like trout fishing and matching the hatch, trying to have a diversity of insects always kind of popping out when different pollinator species are flowering, budding out. Area matching for a wide diversity of invertebrates that can be part of a young rough grouse diet. Simple as that. And so it's thinking more holistically about the management that we do.
Sure. And that makes sense. And then you get the added benefit if you're doing a pollinator project that like that's a huge topic across everywhere right now, like bees and everything else and
exactly.
The lack of them. So if you're able to incorporate that also in the management, it's a whole nother benefit that a lot of people probably don't even realize that Rough Grouse Society is doing right now.
So we're actually, I mentioned briefly the Ottawa National Forest. One of the projects we're working on the Ottawa is through what's called a participating agreement with the Ottawa National Forest. Same time, we're working on a stewardship agreement with the Ottawa National Forest. But as part of our participating agreement, RGS, AWS, and the Ottawa National Forest and the American Bird Conservancy secured $500,000 through the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And so actually we're working with our partners at American Bird Conservancy and the Ottawa National Forest to do about 1,500 acres of work on the Ottawa National Forest, which would include hunter walking trail mowing, maintenance, restoration type work. But a huge chunk of the work that we're doing is going to be working on non-forested openings. Okay. A lot of forested openings that would normally have been full of pollinator species, part of that ecology for rough grouse and woodcock, are just overgrown with trees. So looking at doing commercial and non-commercial treatments in those areas to do some restoration on the landscape as far as creating that diverse ecosystem.
Right. And that's something that I never really thought of, but as soon as you mention it, it makes sense. Even mature grouse, you'll find that they're eating bugs. Like, I've found bugs in crops before. Like, it's part of it. And you don't think about that. You're just like, oh, they're in the forest. But like what you said, like those younger birds need those bugs, those insects and everything else. So like, that's something to really think about, like, not only for me, but for like listeners that are my grouse hunting community and everything else. When they see a project and they see a forest, maybe, well, this used to be forest. Why did they turn it into an open landscape? Right. Like what's going on here? Not knowing that there's so much more to this puzzle.
Yeah. Believe me, there's so much more nuance to it. And there's so much more going on behind the scenes. I get asked quite frequently from members about some of the sharp-tailed grouse work that's happening in the state of Wisconsin, up in the northwest part of the state, where, you know, these vast areas that were jack pine are being cleared and converted to open areas for sharp-tailed grouse habitat. And I do get asked by members if I'm okay with that, if I should be pushing back and saying that needs to stay as forest. But right now, you know, the counties and state are working on actually a really neat concept and initiative where they're implementing what they call their rolling barrens concept. Many of these areas that were formerly utilized by sharp-tailed grouse have grown up to dense thickets of jack pine, which, if you know much about the wild and fire ecology of jack pine, it is a fire-dependent species. It is a dangerous species when it comes to wild and fires. Much of the jack pine we have in the northwest part of the state is fire originated, from the Oak Lake fire, for example. Right now, these jack pine forests are mature and overmature. They are a tinder basket, is what they are.
Sure.
So it's this danger issue on the landscape of these fire dependent ecosystems and a greater wild and urban interface. So the state and counties are taking the initiative of cutting these jack pine areas down to create sharp-tailed grouse habitat, with the idea that they're going to let those areas grow back to trees and timber that then would be utilized by other forested wildlife over time. All the while, they're taking care of other areas and moving the barrens through an area, basically rotating it through, saying we're going to keep a core area of barrens habitat for sharp-tailed grouse because they are part of the landscape, mandate right. For diverse species. Let's take this area of what would be forest, create barrens now, while that sprouts back up, move to the next section and harvest that and create the next area of barrens to maintain a rolling barrens concept. So even thinking about rough grouse society, how we can be supportive of other species that end up at the end of the day helping to benefit active forest management, diverse forests, and rough grouse and woodcock. We can be in support of sharp-tailed grouse habitat because at the end of the day, through different management techniques, it means rough grouse habitat too.
Right, because it's that diverse herbivore. They might not use the barrens, but as they grow back up and mature, and now you're going to have, as they roll it through, depending on how they roll it through, you might have young forests now with middle-aged forests that are close to each other. Now, if you have some older forests, now you just create a rough grouse. Now you just create a rough grouse habitat.
Exactly. And that's what, you asked why I wanted to work for Rough Grouse Society, what got me to work here. It is the fact that as a society, we are supportive of these type of initiatives. We are trying to think more holistically, long-term management, how everything plays in with one another, how we can create these healthy and diverse forested and non-forested ecosystems.
It's really cool to hear all that because I learned a ton. Like, like the pollinator part of it, and like open forest areas and things like that, things that I didn't think Rough Grouse Society necessarily would have much of a part in. And that, but it all like rolls into that bigger picture now. And now I'm getting a better understanding of that bigger picture, which is really, really cool. Because there's so many things I never took into consideration, like when it came to healthy forest, because my mind always thought forest. But you completely opened that up to me realizing it's way more than just the forest.
It's
And I can see why you landed where you are, because you're passionate about it, and it allows you to not like, you're able to just build diverse landscape, because it's more than forest, it's landscape.
Yeah, it's you have to have a pretty high level understanding of a lot of these concepts. There's a reason that they have forestry degrees out there. You need people who can think, who are taught to think more landscape level in terms of the management. People who can get not just the scientific background and training and knowledge, but the real world experience, and put all the parts and pieces together to think about how we can manage at the landscape scale.
It's a big picture. It really is. But I think you did a great job of like really opening my eyes. So I know that other people are going to feel the same way that listen to my show. And the Barrens could be its whole top, like the whole Barrens area. Like I haven't been there, but I've seen pictures of it. And I want to make it there just to experience, because that's a completely unique landscape in itself.
Well, come up this fall.
I'm going to have to. I really do want to. Because from that's really like that little corner of Wisconsin, that's pretty unique, isn't it? Like compared to like anywhere else in the state, like just how the entire landscape.
It's fairly unique. So it's part of the Northwest Sands ecological landscape in Wisconsin, but there's also a Northeast Sands ecological landscape that's fairly similar. I always tell people that, we have very diverse forests here in Wisconsin. And largely we have the glaciers to blame or thanks for that, because they did a number on the geology of our state, the hydrology of our state, and really drove what forested ecosystems we have today. So we have our glaciation to thank for really the diversity of not just our landscapes, but the wildlife that inhabit it. But at the end of the day, it's up to us to... we're in trust with making sure that we can help maintain that right. Diversity of wildlife in our landscape. And I would say, this is maybe where I could do a plug for RGS. If you're interested in learning more about what we're doing, getting active, like I said, we just had a bunch of chapters going out the past few weeks, doing a lot of chapter habitat projects. Get engaged, become a member, become a supporter of the Rough Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society. Go to our website, roughgrousesociety.org. Learn more about what we're doing. We've been working on communicating to our members a lot better about what we're doing as a society. We have tabs on our main landing page related to our different regions. So you can actually search different habitat projects we're working on and read about those projects, find some pictures, video, and learn a lot more about what we're doing as a society. Become a member.
That's awesome. Like I haven't been on the website in a long time, but it's nice to know that you're drilling it down to region specific so people can find out info about either the areas they live or the areas they frequent to hunt. Because when I've been out, because I do a lot of grouse hunting, like I'm up in northern Wisconsin as much as I can possibly be during the fall. It's my favorite time of year to be up there, not only for grouse, but for fishing, everything. If I can move up there, I would. It's just not my cars right now. But when I'm up there, I mean, I've ran into people from Texas, Arizona, the Carolinas, Pennsylvania, from Maine, like all over. So even if you're not from Wisconsin, like you can see like those areas you frequent, those areas you visit, the areas that you come up here to hunt. Now you can drill in to see what's actually happening in those areas and how Rough Grouse Society is benefiting that.
Well, hopefully, like I said, we hired a new forest wildlife specialist in Whitehall, Wisconsin, which is part of the Driftless region. We're really looking at, beyond the Northwoods, Wisconsin for grouse and woodcock habitat. We're part of a society that's currently growing. We're expanding the efforts that we're undertaking in this state and other states. So become a member. We're going to help create some opportunity across the board.
That's awesome. It's awesome to hear you guys starting to work in the Driftless region. I mean, that's its whole unique. Like, if you're a trout fisherman,
we could spend two episodes on the Driftless region.
Oh yeah. If you're a trout fisherman, you've heard of it. I mean, if you haven't, I'd be shocked. But that's this whole unique glacier driven. That's another thing from the glacier, right? So,
a lack of glaciation in that case.
Right. Well, John, I really appreciate you coming on. You just gave a great shout out to the Rough Grouse Society. Is there anybody else you want to shout out? Anything else that listeners you think would benefit if they went and saw or visited? Any of the partners that you think?
There's so much.
I know.
I guess, you know, if you're not following us on Facebook, Instagram, other great way to kind of learn about the society, what we're doing. Learn a little bit more about species, their habitat. Of course, if you do become a member, you want to become more engaged beyond going to one of our banquet fundraisers. We do try to keep members informed on policy related issues that are happening in their states, opportunities to comment. You know, we talk about forest planning and management plans. If there's a state federal plan, something that members should be interested in, knowledgeable about, concerned about. We try to keep members up to date on planning efforts, getting them the opportunity to comment and provide feedback to those plans that drives a lot of the management. So we can help keep you engaged.
And that's really a great tool right there. So don't just, when you become a member, don't just delete the emails thinking they're spam. They're not spam. There's actually useful information in those emails. And when they're asking for help from our input, there's a reason for it. And that's when we have a chance to actually take even more part in the initiative and creating these diverse landscapes. So
everybody's fighting for attention nowadays. So let us fight for your attention, because there are important things happening out there.
And it's those diverse landscapes is what's going to be the future of the grouse and the wildlife and everything else. And if we don't maintain them, because like you said, you can fall behind the eight ball. It's going to be too late at one point.
Yep.
Well, John, I really appreciate you coming on. I learned a ton. Like, I feel like I almost should have taken notes. It's a good thing it's recorded, because I can just go back and listen to it. So
there you go. Thank you, Brad. We'll see you this fall for sharp-tailed grouse.
Yes.
Of course, again, none of them, but we can view them.
Exactly. And I want to make it to check out the Barrens, because I really want to see that landscape. So that's going to have to happen. To all my listeners, thanks for tuning in again. Until next time, keep chasing that experience.
Thanks for tuning in to another killer episode here on Paddle and Fin. Be sure to drop a 5-star rating, a thumbs up, or smash that subscribe button on any platform you're listening in on. Be sure to check us out on Waypoint TV, waypointtv.com. Make sure you sign up for the Fantasy Kayak Fishing League at paddleandfin.com/fantasy. You could support this show through Patreon, patreon.com/paddleandfin. Don't forget to check out the website, paddleandfin.com. Catch us on YouTube. If you got a question, comment, or want to see a future guest on the show, be sure to email us at paddleandfin@gmail.com. Shout out to our show supporters, Yak Gadget. You can check out all the fine kayak accessories at yakgadget.com. Pelican Professional. For all your cases, coolers, and lighting needs, go to pelican.com. Rocktown Adventures. Your Midwest premier paddle sports destination. Go to rocktownadventures.com. Eastport Marina. The beautiful destination on Dale Hollow Lake. If you're looking for lodging, kayaks, kayak accessories, or anything fishing related on the beautiful Dale Hollow Lake, go to eastport.info. And Jigmasters Jigs. When in doubt, get the jig out. Go to jigmasters.com and fill your tackle boxes today.